Officer Eric Shepard, a police officer with the Williston Police Department, was parked in the parking lot of the Vermont State Police Barracks when the call on his radio came through. There were multiple calls coming into 911, reporting that a vehicle was going the wrong way on Interstate 89. It was around 11:45 p.m. on Saturday, October 8th, 2016.
Hi, I'm on Interstate 89 heading south, exit 11. I just passed the car going the wrong way on the wrong side of the highway. He was flying.
Vermont State Police.
Hi, they're Weston on the page 315. Are you aware of the wrong way driver heading south?
I am aware. What was your mile marker?
76.9.
All right.
79.6.
79.6. Thank you very much.
I'm on the highway. I'm on 89, right next to the going to the Richmond exit. There is a car going the opposite way.
Vermont 911, where is your emergency?
There's a car next to the wrong way on the highway.
Okay. Is the vehicle still driving or has it hit anything yet?
Oh, no, it hasn't hit anything yet. It's driving.
Okay. We already have it. The state police are aware, okay?
Officer Shepard and his partner, Sergeant Brian Claffey, who was parked in the police cruiser next to him, both started up their cars to head over to the interstate to look for the wrong way driver. They split up, with Officer Shepard heading southbound toward where the calls were originating from. He got to the Williston rest area, slowed down into the right lane, and started checking the area when another call came through the radio. There had been a car crash approximately a mile away from where he was. He instantly knew it had something to do with that wrong-way driver. He activated his blue lights and siren and sped over to the scene, arriving about 30 seconds later. When he pulled up, he observed a Toyota Tacoma pickup truck completely wrecked in the middle of the highway. Over off onto the grassy median was a white Volkswagen Jetta, completely totaled and engulfed in flames. There were also a couple vehicles that had pulled over, clearly after the crash, and people were just getting out of their cars.
There were others traveling southbound on 89 that night. And as they approached the crash scene, what they saw was horrific. There was debris in the roadway. There was a smashed truck sitting there. And there was a car on fire.
As Officer Shepard stepped out of his vehicle, he heard someone yell that there were people trapped inside of the Jetta. He got a fire extinguisher out of the hatch of his cruiser and ran over. He sprayed the extinguisher at the engine and tried putting the fire out, but to no avail. Then, from the corner of his eye, he noticed that the blue lights from his cruiser were now flashing blue and white, which meant that it was now in drive. It was slowly creeping forward. "Who has my car?" he yelled, realizing that someone was stealing it.
"Who has my car? Who has my car? Somebody just stole my EQ."
His vehicle picked up speed and he radioed to dispatch that his car had just been stolen from the scene. He would later come to find out that it was the wrong way driver, the driver of the pickup truck, that had just taken off in his cruiser. Officer Shepard turned his attention back to the burning Jetta. He could see that there were four people inside, but he couldn't get to them. He tried all the door handles, banged on the windows, and yelled, "Get out of the car! Get out of the car!" None of the occupants were responding. Sergeant Claffey pulled up to the scene, announcing his arrival into the radio, but Officer Shepard instructed him not to stop and to instead go after whoever it was that had stolen his cruiser. By this time, more passersby had stopped to help. He saw a female lying on the ground, not far from the burning Jetta, and he and another man pulled her further away to safety. One of the passers-by was an ER nurse, and another a nurse practitioner. They started performing CPR on the girl when Officer Shepard got another alarming call over the radio. It was Sergeant Claffey, who told him that his cruiser had turned around and was on its way back to the scene, going the wrong way with speeds of about 100 miles per hour. Officer Shepard looked up at the roadway and noticed at least a dozen people alongside a long line of cars that had stopped and were trying to assist with the accident. "Get off the interstate," he yelled to them, and tried his best to clear the road. He heard the roaring engine first, and then saw the blinding, flashing white light he had custom installed on his cruiser, getting closer and closer. He drew his firearm, but with an uncontrolled vehicle going that fast, and with people on the highway, he decided it was best to just take cover. The cruiser crashed head-on into the pickup truck that was still wrecked in the middle of the highway, before striking another car that had been pulled over. Debris and car parts went flying everywhere, and Officer Shepard watched in horror as someone was ejected from his cruiser. He watched, almost in slow motion, as the driver flew out and landed about 20 feet off into the median. The man looked to be in pain as he lay on the ground. "Stop! Police! Show me your hands!" he yelled out, and the man complied. As he got closer, his gun pointed at him, he realized that he recognized the man from a prior law enforcement encounter.
"Are you still sure that this is the man that took your cruiser and was later ejected from it?"
"That's not a face-off for yet."
The driver was 36-year-old Stephen Burgoyne. He had just wreaked havoc on this otherwise quiet night in northern Vermont. When all was said and done, investigators would learn that 5 people lost their lives and 5 more were injured. The interstate was closed down for hours while police investigated both crashes. The question in today's episode is, was it intentional or was Stephen Burgoyne legally insane that night? This is Jillian and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 104. Mary Harris, Cyrus Sow, Liam Hale, and Eli Brookins were 16 years old. Janie Kazi was 15. All were high school juniors, friends since childhood. All were in a Volkswagen Jetta, heading home from a concert in South Burlington on the night they were killed. More than 1,000 mourners gathered at the soccer field at the local high school, where 4 out of the 5 teens attended to honor the lives of those lost in the horrific crash. Daryl Mays, the uncle of Mary Harris, reportedly told the attendees, quote, "Tomorrow is going to be a hard time for all you kids going to school. Be thankful for your friends. Feel blessed that you got to live today. Do your best. Live a great life. That's what you can do for your friends who died." The school's principal released a statement that said, quote, "This is an unprecedented tragedy. We have suffered a tremendous loss. These students were vibrant members of our school community, actively involved, and all with a promise for a bright future." And the then governor, Peter Shumlin, ordered all flags in Vermont to fly at half staff. He tweeted, quote, "In honor of the 5 young Vermonters we lost this weekend, my deepest sympathies are with their loved ones." While the 5 teenagers were pronounced dead at the scene, Stephen Burgoyne was transported to the hospital. Not only would Stephen live, but he would live to face trial for what happened that night. Inside a makeshift courtroom at the University of Vermont Medical Center, where Stephen was recovering from his injuries, he was arraigned on 5 counts of second-degree murder. In the weeks after his arrest, Stephen's toxicology report was leaked to the media. It said that Stephen had high amounts of THC in his system, along with fentanyl, a pain medication, and a sedative. The fentanyl and sedative amounts could reportedly be a therapeutic amount, but he had 10 nanograms of THC in his blood 8 hours after the crash. However, Chittenden County Prosecutor Sarah George told a reporter with WCAX that the toxicology report was irrelevant to her case. Quote, "This toxicology report just shows that he had marijuana in his system. If that was the only factor involved and he was charged with driving under the influence of drugs, this would be a very different conversation," George said. "I didn't want it released because I don't want people trying to justify his actions based on that." Prior to Stephen's trial, his attorneys made it known that he would be pleading insanity, but also prior to trial, reports of a prior arrest surfaced. In May 2016, just 5 months before the crash, Stephen was arrested for domestic assault and unlawful restraint. In the affidavit, Stephen's then-girlfriend alleged that he had tried to kill her. She told police, quote, "When he gets in his moods, he does not think clearly and has no regard for those around him, even his loved ones." Stephen's trial started in May 2019.
On October 8, 2016, at approximately 11:30 p.m., the defendant, Stephen Burgoyne, walked out of his home, got into his pickup truck, and headed towards Richmond. At Richmond, he got on to I-89 going south in the right direction, but then he slams on his brakes, backs his pickup truck up, and turns his truck around, heading north in the southbound passing lane, the wrong way.
Susan Hardin, Chittenden County Deputy State's Attorney, gave the opening statements on behalf of the state of Vermont. She said the force of the impact was so strong that it pushed the Jetta onto the median and killed Mary Harris, Cyrus Sow, Liam Hale, Janie Kazi, and Eli Brookins. She detailed the rescue efforts of Officer Shepard and the many passersby. "But where was the defendant while all this was happening?" she asked. She told them that after the crash, Stephen saw an abandoned police car whose door was open. He got in and took off south down I-89, traveling at a regular rate of speed at first, but then he turned around and headed back to the crash scene he had just left. He then slammed the police car into his pickup truck. Debris hit several cars parked on the side of the road, causing one car to flip on its side. Then the cruiser burst into flames.
How could this have happened? Why would somebody do this? They'd have to be crazy, right? But that's not the question you're going to have to decide. You're going to have to decide whether the defendant was legally insane at the time. You've heard that he's raised the insanity defense, claiming that he was insane at the time that he committed these offenses, claiming that he had a mental disease or defect. And as a result of that mental disease or defect, he was unable to appreciate the criminality of his conduct, or he was unable to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. Think about that, ladies and gentlemen, as you're listening to all of the evidence. Think about what he did before, during, and after these crashes.
She told the jury that Stephen was not legally insane, that he had been very unhappy with his job, was angry about the amount of money he was making, and he was in a bitter custody battle with the mother of his child. Just 12 days prior to the crash, she said, there was a court hearing, and he learned that he would be getting just 1 hour a week with his daughter, 1 hour of supervised visitation. He was angry, she said.
You're going to hear testimony in this courtroom. What the defendant does when he's angry, frustrated, stressed out, the lengths that he will go to when he's feeling that way.
She told the jury that on the Friday before the crash, Stephen left his job at lunchtime and decided to not ever go back. He quit. Afterwards, he went to meet a friend for lunch, and the friend didn't notice anything different about his behavior, only that he complained about his finances, said he was being harassed at work, and vented about the mother of his child taking advantage of him. She said that around 10 or 11 in the morning, on the day of the crash, he went to the emergency room. He was checked in, evaluated, and discharged. She said he told medical personnel that he was stressed about parenting and relationship issues, and that he then went home. Then at 11:30 that night, he left his home to drive the wrong way on Interstate 89. Christopher Page was a neighbor of Stephen's, and he recalled for the court hearing Stephen leave his house that night. He was watching TV, and around 11:25, he heard Stephen's truck engine start. It sounded as though he took off at a high rate of speed. It startled him, and so he got up and went to his window. The truck was gone by that time, but for some reason, he said he was still standing there when just a few seconds later, the truck pulled back into the driveway. He watched as Stephen got out of the vehicle and went back into the house. The garage light came on, and he was in there for about 15 to 20 seconds. The garage light then went off, and Stephen quickly got back into his truck, and again, he backed out of his driveway and quickly accelerated. As he took off, the back end of the truck fishtailed slightly and the tires squealed. He then drove to the end of the street and took a left. Christopher testified that Stephen took the corner so fast that he thought he was going to tip over. Right around midnight, about a half hour later, he heard sirens go off. On cross-examination, Christopher told the court that he also heard Stephen's truck leave multiple times on that Friday morning. This was prior to him waking up around 6 a.m. Keith Porter was traveling southbound on Interstate 89 that night. His wife was driving, their oldest son was in the passenger seat, and he was in the back seat with their younger son. He said he first noticed a car with its hazard lights on that had pulled over on the side of the road. His wife moved over into the passing lane to give that car space, but as they got closer, wreckage appeared in the middle of the highway. They pulled over past the other car. His wife called 911 while he got out with his cell phone. He turned the flashlight feature on so he could wave his phone and warn oncoming drivers that there was wreckage in the middle of the highway. One by one, as cars pulled up, they would pull over and get out to help. He went over to the wreckage, and as he approached, there was a man with facial hair standing there.
He just says, I don't know what happened. I just lost control. In kind of that cadence.
Okay.
I think I was, yeah.
Okay. And did you respond to him in any way?
I know I said something back to him, but I'm not sure exactly what it was.
Did you have any indication that he had been injured or that he needed help? Or?
He was kind of slumped towards me a little bit, and I knew as soon as he said that he'd been in the accident.
How did you know that?
Well, I just assumed that what he was saying to me was that he was the cause of what happened.
And did you ask him if anybody else had been hurt in this crash?
I think that's what I responded back to him about. Are there other people or if someone else was hurt, something along that lines. I don't recall exactly what I said.
He said he could now clearly see the car in the median. He watched as two people pulled what looked like the body of a female away from the car. He ran over to the median, where Officer Shepard was trying to extinguish the fire from the car. After the extinguisher was empty, the fire still wasn't out. Keith walked back up the embankment, and he remembered yelling out, "Does anyone have a fire extinguisher? We need another extinguisher." He recalled hearing Officer Shepard yell for people to get off of the interstate, and he remembered being confused, thinking that he had already helped to block off where the wreckage was. But he joined Officer Shepard anyway and started yelling at cars to get off the interstate. He recalled hearing an engine roar. He looked towards the truck's wreckage and saw a white SUV police vehicle crash into it. He tried to dive towards the median and braced himself, thinking he was going to die. The car hit and then flew into the air towards him.
I felt like a heat or warmth, and I believe something hit my feet and kind of spun me around, like, and I slid a little bit on the highway and realized at some point I remember standing up and...
Did you get injured at all in what happened between the cruiser and the truck?
At the time, I didn't know if I was in shock or if I was really injured. I remember standing up and touching my different parts to see if I was still there. I didn't know what had hit me. I knew I'd been hit by something, but I didn't know the extent of it. And yeah,
he could tell he was bleeding at that point. EMTs came to the scene and he was eventually taken to the hospital. He had lacerations, a broken toe, and bruises.
It was horrible. I felt like there were many things on fire. There were people screaming. I assume that there were many people injured or killed. It was like a war zone. I mean, I say that not, I've actually, you know, I've gone to one, I'm trying to say that lightly, but it was incredibly disturbing. And I, you know, I felt like we're helping who's trying to hurt us, you know, who's coming. Yeah.
Another passerby was Joseph Leuchter Mandel, a critical care nurse at the University of Vermont Medical Center. He was driving home from work when he came across the accident.
There was kind of debris all over the road, and I saw a truck, which was heavily damaged. There was someone who was sort of directing traffic, and I asked if there were injuries, and he didn't seem to know. So I drove past the scene for 100 yards or so, and then parked and got out to help.
Okay, and so you got out of your car, and where did you go?
So I walked up to the truck. The door was open at this point. I was with someone else. I'm not sure who.
We looked. Female.
I believe it was a female.
Okay.
I think.
At this point, were there any law enforcement officers on scene?
No.
Okay. Go ahead. Continue.
So I figured there must have been somebody in the truck. So I looked in the truck for anyone that was hurt, and there was no one in it. I asked somebody who was standing nearby where the driver went, and he pointed south farther down the highway and said he'd walk that way. And it was at that point that I noticed the other car in the median that was on fire.
He and two others went towards the car, the Volkswagen Jetta. He saw that a female was lying face down in the grass not far from them. They dragged her about 20 feet away in case the car exploded. They turned her over, but she wasn't breathing and had no pulse. He started to do CPR on her. He ran back to his car to get a CPR mask and gloves, and it was then that he saw the police car driving onto the scene, going extremely fast.
The remaining car up on the road was sort of behind some trees, but there was a very loud impact and debris flying everywhere and people up on the highway screaming.
He was doing CPR at the time of that crash and continued. He knew that what had just happened wasn't good, but they continued anyway. Their CPR, however, was not successful. Eventually, the fire department showed up and brought a defibrillator. The firemen told them to do one more round of CPR, and if there's no response to the defibrillator, they would stop. The female was pronounced dead shortly after. Joseph walked back up to the interstate, figuring that there would likely be more casualties on the road now. The police cruiser was sideways in the road and was on fire. He heard rounds of ammunition. The police car was exploding, and it sounded like gunfire. After the fire and the police car was out, he went to make sure that there was no one in it. He saw someone on the ground with a couple people around him. He went to make sure he was okay. He helped put the man onto a backboard and put a C-collar on his neck. They then loaded him onto a stretcher and put him in an ambulance. He said the man had no noticeable injuries. He later learned that the man was Stephen Burgoyne.
You know, he wasn't making a lot of sense what he was saying, but he seemed to be conscious.
Okay. So you say, was he talking?
Or he wasn't talking. He may have yelled. That was all that I heard.
Do you know what he was yelling?
It wasn't. I don't even know. I don't even think it was words. I think it was just yelling.
And so he was taken away by ambulance at that point?
Yep.
Susan Janes, a nursing practitioner who also pulled over that night to help, then took the stand.
So we were traveling southbound on Route 89, and as we approached French Hill, we saw just out of the blue a big black piece, looked like a piece of a vehicle, and we knew that we were coming upon something. We also could see up ahead of us a couple of cars that had stopped, so we saw some brake lights up ahead, and this is one of the many memories of that night that go in slow motion, even though it happened in a second. We swerved to avoid that piece, big piece of debris. We got into another chunk of debris, had to swerve the next way. Then in front of us was a vehicle across the road. We had to swerve to get around that. And then beyond that, we saw another vehicle down in the median on fire.
She was looking for possible victims near the wrecks when a police officer, Officer Shepard, pulled up and ran over to the vehicle in the median that was on fire.
He got out of the car and ran immediately to the vehicle. He was absolutely incredible. It was probably the most amazing bravery that I have ever witnessed. He worked really hard to get to the victims. He had a fire extinguisher. He tried to break the windows. He went to several doors, wrapping his jacket around his hand, trying to open the doors, trying to help the victims.
She said she saw a darkening in the grass behind the vehicle. At the same time, another first responder saw it too. They ran down and started CPR on a female in the grass. She said they worked on her for about 5 to 10 minutes. Eventually, other aid came. They did one more cycle, and the EMT called the code.
So while we were doing CPR on Mary, we heard just a bizarre sound, which was a huge just whoosh coming from the Richmond side of the interstate, and then a huge, huge collision. So we didn't know what had happened. At that point, we were next to the car, which was getting hotter, and the tires were popping. We didn't know if the vehicle up on the road had blown up or what, but something had clearly happened. So when we came back up the embankment, it was a completely different scene than what we had left when we came down to help Mary.
So could you just please describe the scene?
I mean, it looked like a war zone. It looked like an Armageddon. It looked like, you know, things had blown up. There was debris everywhere. There was another car on fire. There was a car upside down on outside of the breakdown lane. There was just carnage. There was just stuff everywhere.
Vermont State Trooper Matthew Nato described seeing Stephen Burgoyne held up at gunpoint on the ground after the second crash. He said Stephen was screaming, but he couldn't understand what he was saying. On cross-examination, he was questioned more about this.
Did the screaming make you think he was feeling any particular way, the individual on the ground?
I can't speculate. I heard screaming. I can't really interpret what it meant.
Okay. You remember taking a deposition in this case?
I do.
You remember saying that literally just loud noises? He was just like he was frightened. It wasn't anything where he was saying words. He was just screaming. You remember saying that?
Correct.
Okay. So he was screaming like he was frightened.
Sure.
On redirect, the prosecution continued with that line of questioning.
Judge, just briefly.
Yes.
at the time that he was screaming, he had two officers with their guns pointed at him, correct?
That's correct.
And then you arrived and you were also pointing your gun at him. Is that correct?
Correct.
Trooper Bradley Miller was also at the scene when Stephen was taken into custody. He and Officer Shepard got him into handcuffs and then moved him further away from the cruiser, which was on fire. He told the court that Officer Shepard was always very calm in these sorts of situations, but this time he was not acting like he normally does.
He seemed, I guess the best way to put it, is almost lost. At that moment, he wasn't concentrated. His mind was elsewhere. I had to ask him multiple times to help me move the individual away from his car because he started wandering around away from where we were at until he came back and helped me move him.
What did you attribute this change in his demeanor to?
I'd assume just the overall scene, the chaos there and stress of what everything was going on from seeing a cruiser crash right in front of him.
Trooper Miller said that once they had Stephen in custody, he started asking him questions.
I asked him if he was involved in the crash, if he was in the car that was in the median, if he was involved in that.
And so when you're asking him these questions, you don't know the answers, right?
No.
Okay. So you were trying to just get information from him?
Yes.
And did he respond to you?
No.
Okay. Did you ask this person what his name was?
Yes.
How many times do you think that you asked him?
I must have asked him 3 to 4 times at least.
And did he give you his name?
Eventually, yes.
And what did he say that his name was?
Stephen Burgoyne.
Okay. And did you ask him specifically to spell his last name for you?
Yeah, I couldn't really understand how he was saying his last name, so I asked him to spell it for me a couple times.
Okay. And did he ultimately spell it for you?
Yes.
Okay. And did he spell it clearly for you? Could you understand him?
Yes, he said it rapidly as well.
Okay.
He told the court that there was a passerby who was a doctor and who offered to help provide medical care to Stephen.
Did you take Mr. Burgoyne's handcuffs off at any point during this interaction?
Yes, the doctor asked if I could take the handcuffs off because he said it was making it hard for him to breathe.
Okay, and was he also trying to get his blood pressure?
Yes.
Okay, and so did you, in fact, take the handcuffs off?
Yes.
And how did Mr. Burgoyne respond to having his handcuffs taken off?
He attempted to get up at that point.
Okay. And was he successful?
He did a quick spin, and I think he got up to maybe his knee, but then I was able to get him back onto the ground and put him back in handcuffs again.
He said it was the one time he was alone with him on scene. On cross-examination, Trooper Miller was questioned about his characterization of Stephen's alleged escape attempt.
And it appears that, at least from the video, that Mr. Burgoyne starts to move, but then kind of rolls. Is that what happens?
From my opinion, it was a conscious decision that he made to move and roll away from me and everyone else on scene.
But regardless of what you believe was going on in his mind, what happened was he made a movement and then he started to roll, correct?
He made a quick movement and rolled, yes.
Okay, and he rolled down the slope?
Yes.
Not very far, you were right there, correct?
Correct.
And you stopped him from moving?
Correct.
But Laura Howland, another passerby, testified that she saw Stephen try to escape too.
So when they took the handcuffs off, Stephen tried to get up and run.
So tell us what you mean by he tried to get up and run.
So when they took the handcuffs off, he went to get off from the ground and take off again. He tried to get away.
She testified that it was really hard to hear because Stephen kept yelling. The state called other witnesses who were at the scene of the crash that night, including a woman who suffered serious injuries after her car was hit by the cruiser, and a man whose car flipped over onto its side after his car was hit. That man, Michael Plunkett, was with one of his friends who happened to be recording on his cell phone at the time they were hit. The cell phone video was played for the jury, and it's quite jarring. Michael can be heard screaming, "Oh my God, oh my God, ow, ow." Aside from the many eyewitnesses the state presented, They also called multiple experts to the stand to testify about the crash itself. Detective Sergeant Amy Nolan with the Vermont State Police testified that a search was conducted on Stephen's vehicle. It was completely totaled, but she could tell that Stephen had been wearing his seatbelt at the time of the crash. It was stretched out, indicating that he was seated and belted. Trooper Owen Ballinger, a crash reconstruction leader with the Vermont State Police, examined the scene after the crashes had occurred. He noted that there was no evidence of any skid marks. Of the Jetta, he said there was grass found in the left corner on the outside of the trunk, meaning that part of the car had come into contact with the grass at some point. It had overturned prior to coming to rest. Trooper Ballinger testified that he believes Mary was sitting in the middle of the back seat, not restrained, and when the vehicle rolled over, she was ejected through the sunroof. Investigators were able to tell from a module located inside the Tacoma's airbag just how fast the Tacoma was going. It was in the southbound passing lane when it crossed into the southbound travel lane and struck the Jetta. At 4.8 seconds before impact, it was going 81.5 miles per hour. At 3.3 seconds, the steering wheel was turned slightly to the left into the travel lane. It was going 86.6. At 2.3 seconds prior to impact, the speed increased to 89.8 miles per hour. And the steering wheel was turned more to the left. At 1.8 seconds, the steering wheel was slightly turned to the right, while the speed remained at 89.8. At 1.3 seconds, the steering wheel was turned hard to the right, and the speed slightly decreased to 86 miles per hour. The vehicle's brakes were applied. At 0.8 seconds, the steering wheel was turned more to the right, and the speed decreased to 83.4. The brakes were applied. And at 0.3 seconds before the crash, the steering wheel was again turned to the right, and speed went down to 78.3. The brakes were applied. At impact, the steering wheel was moved back to the left, and the vehicle was registering at 78.4 miles per hour. There were no skid marks at the scene, but the vehicle was also equipped with anti-lock brakes. While the Tacoma was going 78.4 miles per hour, the Jetta was going 32 miles per hour. One officer testified that that indicates to him that the driver of the Jetta saw something that concerned him and was slowing down. The electronic data from the police cruiser showed that just prior to that impact, the cruiser was going from 97 miles per hour to 107 miles per hour. No braking. They were also able to tell that the blue lights on the cruiser had been turned off at some point prior to the crash. Investigators were not able to get any data from the Jetta. It was a 2004, and Volkswagens were not supported by a data system until 2013. Stephen's defense attorney, Robert Kadams, said what happened that night isn't fair, is unjust, and that it's unthinkable that five children lost their lives. This trial is not about whether Stephen drove his truck the wrong way on 89, he said. He did. This trial is about why it happened, what was going on in Stephen's head, why in the world would he do such a thing?
The evidence will be that Stephen Burgoyne was totally psychotic and delusional at the time of the crash. The evidence will be that he was, in every sense, insane at the time of the crash. All the evidence points to that conclusion.
He said Stephen was depressed for years, but really deteriorated in the days before the crash. He became delusional, thinking he was seeing or getting some sort of messages about a government mission he was supposed to participate in. And he thought he had inadvertently stumbled across something on the internet that he wasn't supposed to see, and now he was in danger. Kadams then gave the jury a look into Stephen's background. He said he was raised in Massachusetts, but his family moved around five times before the age of 12. At age 10, his house burned down and his dog died. At age 12, His parents divorced and he moved in with his mom. She passed away the following year, and he had to go live with his maternal aunt for a while. He said Stephen had anxiety as a child and had what was consistent with undiagnosed ADHD. He eventually moved in with his dad in Vermont, but his dad and stepmother had issues with him, and he ended up living on his own his senior year. After that, he said Stephen went into the Army, but was medically discharged after basic training due to an eye condition. He was bitterly disappointed by that. In 2008, he broke up with his then-girlfriend and developed major depression, for which he was prescribed Prozac. Later in 2008, he met a woman named Anila Lawrence, but after dating for a few years, he started to get mood swings. She got pregnant and they had a daughter, but their relationship fell apart. And Stephen's condition grew worse. Kadams told the jury that around the time of the crash, Stephen would go driving at night instead of sleep. And just a few days prior to the crash, he thought he was seeing messages from the government that were just for him.
And by Thursday into Friday, he's not sleeping at all. He's thinking two different things. In the beginning, he's excited. This is his dream come true. He's being selected for some type of mission, for some type of government-sponsored mission. He got discharged from the Army, but now he's being selected.
Kadams detailed a bizarre trip he said Stephen took on the Friday before the crash. At around noon, he started driving around, and he got what he thought were subtle directions from his radio. He drove south, out to where the radio told him to go, but there was nothing. Kadam said he then started becoming paranoid.
He then is toggling between excitement and paranoia. He starts to think, well, maybe it's not a mission. Maybe I stumbled upon something on the internet I shouldn't have. And they're going to trick me to get me somewhere, and they're going to harm me. And so he is going between these two things, how many doesn't know.
He told the jury how he then quit his job, which was totally bizarre behavior. And by Friday night, he said things really started to go in a bizarre direction.
By Friday night, he's getting directions to go to somewhere. And he follows those directions and he ends up in a cornfield by the river in Essex by the airport. And he thinks, again, he's got to follow the directions, the communications through either his cell phone or the car, parks his truck, goes into the woods, and he's excited. Again, he thinks he's headed somewhere. He thinks at some point he's being watched. He hears something like a helicopter, thinks maybe it's a drone. But he gets to the cornfield, and there's the moon shining down the path of the cornfield. And he thinks that this is it. This is the path. It's for me. And so he continues to go down that path, and he heads towards the river. And he gets to the river, and he's there, and he believes he's getting the message to disarm. So he's got a knife with him, a K-bar knife. He's had it for 20 years, and he throws it in the river. And then he goes back up towards his truck, and he hears some noises, thinks he's being watched, but then he ends up going back down towards the river, and all of a sudden there's a circular tunnel just for him. He believes it's there, and he crawls through it. It's too good to be true. How could this all be laid out for him? He gets to the water, and he felt like the direction at that point to him was to get in the water, that he was supposed to get in the water. But he doesn't do it. He's scared. He thinks, wait, this is where they're going to kill me.
He said Stephen heard splashes and thought maybe Navy SEALs were in the water. He was completely out of his mind, he said. He then took his phone, smashed it on a rock, and threw it into the river. Kadam said that phone records show that Stephen's phone goes dead at 8:42 that night, supporting his story of having smashed it and thrown it into the river. He then went home, washed his clothes, and went out driving again. By 4 a.m., he went to a friend's house, with such bizarre behavior that his friends were concerned. He left, and by 8:40 a.m., he went to the hospital. He got into the secured portion of the emergency room, and security was called in to ask him to leave. At 9:39 a.m., he went back to the hospital. This time, he went and checked in and got coded in as a crisis. He spoke to the triage nurse, but eventually he just up and left the hospital. He had been up for days at this point, Kadam said. Later that night, Stephen left his house again. This was right before the crash. Kadam said he recalls driving, but has no memory of driving the wrong way. Moments before the crash, he said Stephen tried to swerve and avoid it. He said after the crash, Stephen went down to the embankment and looked inside the vehicle. He didn't see children, but saw what he thought were mannequins with breathing apparatuses on. He turned to leave, looked up, and saw red and blue lights. They were communicating with him. He got into the police cruiser, started driving, has some memory of turning around, and then there's the second crash.
He suffers massive, massive injuries from the two accidents. His hip is broken, his multiple fractures of his face. He's near comatose when he gets to the hospital and remains that way for days.
He said 6 days later, Stephen was wheeled into a conference room at the hospital and charged with the offenses.
You will also hear that there's no evidence that intoxication had anything to do with this event, that there's no evidence that suicide had anything to do with this event. He was wearing a seatbelt at the time of the initial crash. And there's no evidence that he's in some type of blind rage, upset about his finances or his child custody.
This is a case about evidence, he said. And evidence shows that Stephen was insane at the time of the crash. The defense's first witness was a very reluctant one. Anila Lawrence sat on the stand with her head down, gave short answers, and at some points was visibly shaking as she testified. She said she met Stephen in October 2008 at a friend's wedding. A couple weeks later, they went out again and started dating. In 2013, she got pregnant. Before the pregnancy, she said their relationship was good. They took trips to Mexico, the Bahamas, Jamaica, and California. They bought a house together in 2010. On June 3rd, 2013, she told him she was pregnant. He was on his way home to propose to her when she found out. After that, she said she saw a change in him. Their finances were tight, and Stephen would get frustrated and angry about it. At the time, he was working at Toyota, but he left there right before their daughter was born. After Anila went back to work, he stayed at home with their daughter. She said Stephen's moods continued to fluctuate, and he would have intense mood swings that she had never seen from him before. She told the court that they planned on getting married. They had a small ceremony, but never got a marriage license. They had booked a venue in Vermont and invited a lot of people, but they soon canceled it.
From what I remember, we left the inn at Essex, and he was frustrated with dealing with all the, nuances of all the trying to get everyone together and everything, and people trying to do things their way. And so he said, we're not going to have a bridal party or groomsmen or anything. So we called all of them and told them we weren't going to do that.
And that was because of Stephen, correct?
Yes.
And you found that weird, didn't you?
Yes.
She said Stephen stopped drinking alcohol in July 2013, although she said he still smoked marijuana. Towards the fall in 2013, more mood swings.
Getting angry at little things that mostly the money stuff or bills or shut off notices and such.
And when you say mood swings, would it swing back then? In other words, he would be angry and upset, and then what would happen after he was angry and upset.
Usually calm down.
After their daughter was born, Stephen stayed home for a while. He wasn't too keen on going back to work right away, which was strange to her because he was always a really hard worker. Instead, he told her she should try and find a better job that made more money. She said that was always an ongoing thing. The mood swings continued. He would say things to her that he would never normally say, and it raised red flags for her. As for whether Stephen ever went to a doctor, she said he had talked to one about being depressed and that the doctor had suggested taking antidepressants, but he didn't want them. She said he had lost friends to drug overdoses and didn't want to be addicted to anything like that. In September 2014, she said he told her he was done taking care of their daughter and that she had to quit her job. It surprised her a lot. He wanted to move, and so they rented out their condo and moved to Massachusetts. They stayed with family. She said he was trying to go back to school at the time. She then recounted a time right around then when he physically assaulted her.
I came home halfway through the workday. He was upset and wouldn't give me our daughter. Told me I wasn't welcome at his aunt's house anymore. Grabbed me by the hair, knocked my glasses off. Said I could come back and get her once I had a place to stay.
And did you find this behavior strange?
Yes.
And so did you call the police?
I went there.
Okay. So you went to the police?
Once I had my daughter.
She got their daughter and went back to Vermont while Stephen remained in Massachusetts. They went to court and he was confined to the state of Massachusetts for a month and had to undergo counseling. Eventually, they reconnected, and at some point, he moved back to the Burlington area in late winter or spring. They started living together again at their old condo in November 2015. Stephen started working at Lake Champlain Chocolates. Anila testified that Stephen started staying up later at night and was looking stuff up online. She thought he was depressed. When she had first met him, he was social, but now he didn't even have anyone over anymore. She said he would stay home and be in bed all day. She said he would also push his family members away. This was also different behavior than how he used to be. Stephen's grandmother passed away in May 2016, and she said he was very upset. He loved her very much. She then cried and started shaking when Kadams asked her about another assault, also in May 2016. She said it was again when she got home from work, and he was angry about their finances. He told her to leave, and so she took their daughter and was putting her in her car seat when Stephen came over and started trying to pull them out of the car and pulling her work lanyard that was around her neck. She said she had the type of car that didn't require a key. You just push the button to start it. And so he did, with her and her daughter in the back seat. She said she couldn't even buckle her daughter into the car seat. He was screaming and was upset. He kept driving. She doesn't remember how long it was, but towards the end, he threatened to drive them into a pond. That's when she verbally agreed to 50-50 custody so he would take them home. It worked and he calmed down. When they got home, he got into the shower and she left with their daughter. She went to the police station and got a restraining order. Stephen stayed in their condo while she went to live with family in Burlington. She changed her phone number. She went to the condo and retrieved some of her personal items. She said the condo was meticulously neat. She went back to the condo about a week later, and Stephen had packed up most of hers and her daughter's stuff. She said it seemed to be a lot messier and dirtier, even though Stephen was normally a clean person. From May through September, she said Stephen didn't have any contact with her daughter. But at a hearing in September, she was granted sole legal and physical rights of their daughter, while Stephen was granted one-hour visits on Saturday mornings when she was at gymnastics. At the hearing, Anila said she had testified that Stephen's mental stability wasn't there. On October 1st, 2016, Stephen visited their daughter for the first time at her gymnastics class. She said Stephen told their daughter that he was going to come that following Saturday, and her daughter was excited about that. He told her he would bring her chocolates from his work. On cross-examination, Anila was asked more about their financial issues and how Stephen would respond to them. She said the truck Stephen drove, the Toyota Tacoma, was in her father's name because Stephen didn't have good enough credit to buy it himself. She said Stephen was often unhappy at his jobs, regardless of what job he was working at the time. He would also complain about her not making enough money and wanted her to get another job. Financial issues would make him angry, she said. He would insult her and tell her things like, since she was adopted, she wouldn't know what it was like to be a mom, and he made fun of her ethnicity. On at least two occasions, she said the stress ended in violence against her. She recounted another incident when she was 6 months pregnant, and he told her he didn't want to be with her anymore, didn't want the baby, and didn't want to get married. He told her to leave. Anila was then asked to go into more detail about that first time he assaulted her.
You said that he pulled your hair. Did he actually pull hair out?
Yes.
Okay, and did you take that hair from the floor and bring it with you to the police department?
Correct.
And where was Izzy when this was happening?
He was holding her for part of it.
As for the other time he assaulted her, she said she went into her daughter's room when he started getting angry and her daughter locked the door. He shook the handle and then her daughter opened the door.
And he continued to yell about your financial struggles after that, right?
Correct.
And he actually took the heel of his hand and he hit you in the side of your head?
Yes.
And he pushed you up against the wall?
Correct.
Telling you to leave?
Correct.
And he used his forearm to hold you against the wall while you were holding Izzy. Isn't that right?
Correct.
And she started to cry and was scared?
Correct.
Okay. Then he took all of your stuff out of the bedroom, dumped it into the middle of the area, and told you to get out. Now.
Yes, correct.
Okay. And so you grabbed some garbage bags and you put the clothing in the garbage bags?
Correct.
And while you were doing that, he kept pulling you back by your hair. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So you told us that you jumped into the car and were trying to put Izzy in her car seat, and the defendant gets into the car and he takes off driving.
Correct.
Okay. And he goes out Route 2 up towards Essex. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And then he went back through Williston.
Correct.
Into Williston Village.
Correct.
And the whole time he's screaming about finances. Isn't that right?
Correct.
And he's screaming that he's not going to give you your daughter unless it was 50-50 custody. Do you remember that?
Correct.
Okay. And he drives up through Essex, right corners, back into Williston, then out towards South Burlington.
Correct.
Okay. And was there a pond out there in South Burlington that you went near?
Yes.
Okay. And was he speeding this whole time that he's driving through all of these different towns?
Driving erratically.
Okay. And that's when you get to where the pond was in South Burlington, that's when he said when he threatened to drive you all in there into the pond?
Correct.
And he said, fine, we can all just go together and we'll all just die in the pond.
Correct.
Okay. And at that point you said, okay, I'll give you 50-50 custody because you figured that was the only way you were going to get home?
Correct.
Okay. And he started to calm down and you went back to your house.
Correct.
Okay.
The court issued a final order of protection for her. She said Stephen asked the court for physical custody but was denied. She said he wasn't happy about that. The prosecutor asked her about how she testified at that hearing and said that Stephen's mental stability wasn't there. She said that was based on what happened when he assaulted her. She told the court that he had told her he wanted to commit suicide before, but never told her about the government being after him.
Did the defendant ever to you about helicopters following him?
No.
Or the government surveilling him?
I don't think so.
Or him receiving messages from his radio?
No.
Or about him being on some type of mission?
No.
And then the prosecution got another piece of information out of her, information that the defense was entirely unaware of.
Have you spoken to the defendant about what happened on October 8, 2016?
Not really, no.
So is it correct that the only thing he's ever really told you about what happened on October 8, 2016, that there were no wrong way signs on the highway?
Correct.
Thank you.
After a brief hearing outside the presence of the jury, the judge decided to tell them to disregard Anila's last statement about what Stephen said to her after the crash. The defense had claimed that the prosecution never told them about that information, and the prosecution said they had handed all the information over, although they couldn't remember exactly when and didn't have proof to back it up. So all parties agreed to tell the jury to strike Anila's comment. The defense continued their case with Alan Kosabik, an old co-worker and friend of Stephen's. He testified that Stephen was often stressed about financial issues and about Anila, but he was more stressed than usual, he said. On the Friday before the accident, he said they went to Five Guys for lunch. Stephen had called him and told him he quit his job and wanted to talk. He appeared to be stressed, same as he was for the past couple months. Then he said Stephen showed up at his house after midnight on that Saturday morning, around 4 a.m. He didn't normally stop by at that time.
Did Mr. Burgoyne, can you have a conversation? I mean, why did he tell you why he was there at 4 o'clock in the morning?
He kind of chuckled a little bit and said he asked if Vanilla was there, and he said that he got a text from her or something like that, and I let him in, and he kind of paced around the house. We talked a little bit again about the marital problems. He used the restroom and left.
A registered nurse who worked at the University of Vermont Medical Center testified that Stephen came into the emergency room later that morning on the day of the crash. She called security after she saw him acting suspiciously.
I was in our break room, which is separate from the clinical area, and I was with two other individuals. We went to leave the break room. The door opens inward, and the first person to open the door, and there was a man standing in the doorway, slightly off to one side. The two people I was with went past him. I stepped through the door and pulled the door shut behind me to make sure it closed all the way. And then turned to this individual and said, or me or one of the other two people I was with, I'm not sure. Someone asked him, could we help you? And he said, no, I'm looking at this poster. And we walked away. I then ran to security and reported that there was an individual in a private part of the department or a non-public part of the department.
She described why she first thought it was suspicious.
Because when I stepped through the door, he was maybe 6 or 7 inches away from me and hadn't stepped back the way people typically do when someone's coming out of a door or an elevator that you're trying to get into.
A security officer came and told Stephen that he had to leave.
So he was standing in the hallway reading something on the wall. I don't remember exactly what. I approached him from behind, introduced myself, explained to him he couldn't be hanging out in that part of the hallway. He turned headwise and just, I'm sorry, I'll just leave. And he walked down the hallway.
Another security officer testified that Stephen told him he needed the phone number from the poster he was looking at, and so he wrote it down for him before following him out. He said the poster was about something unrelated. When Stephen returned to the hospital about an hour later, the nurse who checked him into the emergency room testified that when she asked him why he was there, he told her that he was having relationship issues and that he had concerns relating to a safe place. She said she asked if he was suicidal or homicidal, and he said no. He then asked her to read to him the pain sheet chart that they had hanging up, and so she did. He then told her his pain was a zero. She testified that he would hesitate after each question she asked him. She later told detectives that his sentences were fractured and disjointed in nature. She gave him a warm blanket and told him a provider would be in shortly. That provider testified too. She said when she asked what brought him in, he told her that he was there for physical rest. He then said he had stress in his life, and he spoke about different topics, including separation from his girlfriend, starting a new job on Monday, and associated changes in his life that were going on. She asked in multiple ways if he was feeling suicidal, and he said no to each question. She said they talked at length and then discussed next steps. She suggested that he should see a mental health or crisis physician, and he declined. She gave him the contact info for one anyway, and also spoke with him about following up with his primary care physician. He verbalized that he understood and that he was reassured. She left to go get his discharge paperwork, but before she could give it to him, the nurse told her that he had changed back into his clothes and had left. Shannon Roberto, an EMT who took care of Stephen at the scene of the crash, said she rode with him in the back of the ambulance and that he was in and out of responsiveness. When he would become out of it, she would give him a sternum rub to see if he responded to pain. He would then wake up, say a few words, and then be unresponsive again.
And did he seem aware of what was happening?
When he would be awake and talking, he was asking random phrases, like, where am I? Where are we going? Or take me to the hospital, things like that. So he seemed confused, but he was able to speak in phrases.
Okay. And when he was awake, was there anything that he said to you that you thought was odd?
When he was awake and talking to me, besides the phrases that I already said, he seemed to be confusing me for someone else. And he said things like, did you dye your hair? Or something about me having children. He said, like, do you have two kids? Things like that. And I acknowledged that that was odd because I never met him prior to the incident.
The defense played video footage from a body cam worn by one of the police officers that night. In it, Stephen is being handcuffed on the ground, and you can hear him groaning loudly as he struggles and then falls silent. Then he would start groaning and struggling again and then fall silent again. In order to try and prove their claim that Stephen was legally insane at the time of the crash, the defense called numerous expert witnesses to the stand. Dr. David Rosemarin, the director of forensic psychiatry at McLean Hospital, said legal insanity in Vermont involves two prongs. One, he said a person is not responsible for criminal conduct if at the time of the conduct it was the result of mental disease or defect. And two, he or she lacks adequate capacity either to appreciate the criminality of his or her conduct or to conform his or her conduct to the requirements of law. Dr. Rosemarin testified that the situation doesn't require both prongs to be proven. It could be either one. As for the first one, he said he believes Stephen did have a mental disease or defect.
He had bipolar disorder with psychotic features, rapid cycling, meaning a certain number of episodes per year,
That was his diagnosis.
He said the evidence supports his diagnosis. He was then asked about the second prong, if he believed that Stephen could appreciate the criminality of his conduct.
No.
Why not? Summary for
him. He did not intend to go the wrong direction and kill people or kill himself. He did not intend that. He was doing the same thing he had been doing for 2 days, which is driving around frantically, trying to preserve his life, trying to understand what he had to do next to be safe. The last day was primarily about his safety. Were they going to kill him? Were they going to kill Izzy? Were they going to burn down his house? He was trying to be safe, and he was in such a state of psychotic frenzy and confusion, and listening to the directions, his inferences from the radio and lights in the environment, that this is a simple psychotic error, not an intentional act.
He also testified that he does not believe Stephen was suicidal that night.
Well, he was wearing a seatbelt. That's number one. Number two, as we've talked about, he had made all these efforts to avoid being injured. He had, thrown his new cell phone and smashed up his new cell phone. He had guarded his house and slept on the couch the day before because he thought they were going to come burn his house. He had thrown his knife in. He'd bought a pumpkin muffin. Well, he had been a hypochondriac, and he was afraid of dying. And he told Dr. Kapoor, that he had had so much death in his life, his grandmother, his mother, his father, his dog, his first girlfriend, his very close friend's wife who suicided, that he just couldn't tolerate anymore. He loved his daughter. He would never abandon his daughter. He had never made suicide attempts ever in his whole life, even when depressed. True, he had had some thoughts of death, which is one of the categories for having a major depression, but he had never taken actions to harm himself. And that was when he was depressed. Here he is, psychotic and fearing for his life.
He was asked if he thought Stephen was in any type of rage.
No one observed him to be rageful. He wasn't rageful at the hospital. He was frightened and sort of cuddling under the warm blankets. No one saw him as rageful at all in those several days. He was frightened. He was terrified. He was confused. He was frantic.
And finally, he was asked about the alleged escape attempt.
So when I watched the videos, what I saw him when he was tied up, he was being hoisted and screaming in pain. While he was already handcuffed. So that would certainly put a lot of fear into him. He had a the head of his femur was out of place, and the hip socket was fractured. We call it comminuted into many pieces. I can understand how he's really hurting, besides his head injury and his fractured spine. So he's being hoisted up by his arms. I saw that on the video. So I can understand why he's afraid of those people who are doing that.
Dr. Baranowski testified that she evaluated Stephen twice while he was in prison. She gave him 3 tests, malingering, a cognitive IQ test, and a personality test. She testified that she saw no malingering or exaggeration in any of his psychotic symptoms, and that, in fact, he denied having any psychotic symptoms. She concluded that he has a borderline personality disorder. Rena Kapoor, a forensic psychiatrist at Yale, also concluded that Stephen has a borderline personality disorder. She was actually first hired by the state, but after she reached her conclusions, the state decided not to use her, and so she was now testifying for the defense. She said she believed that the stress Stephen was under triggered a psychotic episode.
And so that's essentially what I think happened around the time of the crime, is that he had was under a tremendous amount of stress related to financial problems and his custody arrangement with his daughter, and that those stressors then triggered a psychotic episode, including paranoid ideation, around the time of the crime.
She said Stephen was paranoid. He had a tendency to harbor grievances and think people were out to get him.
If you look over the course of his life, there's sort of this persistent pattern of people are biased against me, discriminating against me. So like beginning in high school, you know, he thought that people in Vermont were biased against him because he was from Massachusetts. He thought the FBI was harassing him because he hung out with people of color. He, later in his life, he thought that his coworkers, both at a car dealership and then at Lake Champlain Chocolates, that they were harassing him and out to get him. That kind of thing was a pattern over his life.
One of the last witnesses the defense called to the stand was a man named Cy Ray, who works for a company that provides mapping as it relates to data obtained by mobile devices or cell phone records. He testified that he was given a timeline by the Vermont State Police detailing what Stephen had told them about his whereabouts in the days leading up to the crash. The story about him hearing directions on his radio, thinking he was on a government mission, and then becoming paranoid. He said he looked into Stephen's records and that they corroborated many parts of his story, including when he said he went to a river and smashed his phone against a rock the day before the crash. He said the records abruptly stopped right after that trip. He also mapped out Stephen driving around in the days leading up to the crash, but said he can't speak to whether it was erratic or whether there was underlying meaning for it. On cross, he said Stephen told investigators that he went to Hinesburg, but that the cell phone data shows that his device did not go there. Stephen had also said he went into Montpelier at one point, but he didn't find evidence to corroborate that either. In the rebuttal case, prosecutors called a self-employed physician who happened to be driving on Interstate 89 on October 8, 2016, when he came across the car crash in the median. He pulled his car over and saw a man lying on the ground with an officer standing over him. He went over and asked the officer if he could examine the man, and the officer said yes. He told the man that he was a medical doctor and that he wanted to help him. He asked him his name, but the man didn't respond at first. He repeated himself, and the man said his name was Stephen Burgoyne. He said Stephen was turned with his head down and eyes closed.
So you said his eyes were closed. Did that concern you at all?
It concerned me because I wanted to evaluate his pupils to see if they were equal and reactive, to see if there were signs of pinpoint pupils or anything to do with intoxication. But he kept his eyes closed and he would not let me open them.
Okay, and did that concern you at all?
Yes, it did. It seemed like a purposeful resistance to me when I've already identified myself as a medical doctor.
He asked Stephen if he was experiencing any pain, and he clearly responded that he had pain in his back and hip. He was asked if Stephen was yelling or screaming at that time, and he said no. He then asked the officers if they could take the handcuffs off so he could get his blood pressure, and they did.
I was able to take a blood pressure as best I could. We were outside, and I was able to ascertain that his blood pressure was below normal.
Okay, and he allowed you to do that?
Yes, he did.
Okay, and then what's the next thing that happened?
I noticed that with the handcuffs were off while I was, I'm not 100% sure, but I think I was interacting with the nurse at that point, and I was thanking her for helping out, and he had the handcuffs off. And then he just jumped up and tried to run.
He testified that he was concerned that he may have a concussion due to a bump on his head and swollen nose. He told the court that he's familiar with patients having psychotic episodes, and that's not what was happening with Stephen.
Okay, and based on your education, training, and experience as a physician, at the time that you observed and examined this man on the ground who had been handcuffed, was this man in an acute psychotic episode?
Absolutely not.
Was he out of touch with reality?
Absolutely not.
Was he hallucinating?
He was not hallucinating.
Was he delusional?
He was not delusional.
Was he paranoid?
He was not paranoid.
Any thought disorganization?
There was no thought disorganization, and he cooperated with me to get his blood pressure, examine him, check his head, take his blood pressure, feel his pulse. There was no lack of cooperation during that time.
One of Stephen's co-workers from Lake Champlain Chocolates testified that Stephen would often complain about how stressful it was to work there, and he would often butt heads with his co-workers. He also generally disagreed with how the company was run. He testified that Stephen would sometimes talk about personal incidents from childhood, and that one time, Stephen told him that he was going to commit suicide, but that his brother had talked him out of it. He said he didn't notice anything strange or different about Stephen's behavior leading up to the crash, including on the Friday before, when he abruptly quit. Vermont State Police Detective Carrie Crick analyzed phone and text records from Stephen's cell phone. She said part of Stephen's story was that he had received a Facebook message from a childhood friend on October 7th that had been completely out of the blue and that he had found odd. But she testified that when she looked at the records, it was actually Stephen who had initiated the contact with the old friend and not the other way around. Stephen had also said he was receiving Facebook messages from the government, and that's why he smashed his phone, but she didn't see any such messages in his account. She noted that in the week leading up to the crash, he was receiving several calls a day from bill collectors, including from PayPal and Capital One Bank. And on October 7th, a little more than 24 hours before the crash, Stephen had made a call to a bankruptcy attorney. Detective Crick also looked at Stephen's web searches. He searched for things like clowns, Julian Assange, and how to find the right spouse. She testified that at the time, there was a kind of nationwide panic about clowns showing up in random places. As far as his text messages, he often talked to his friend Alan's wife late at night about his daughter and about other general topics, but nothing seemed out of the ordinary.
In your review of the phone records, the contact information between the defendant and others, did you ever come upon any text messages containing anything, any language that was of concern to you?
No.
Anything about his mental health?
No.
She testified that Stephen had told them he was getting messages about where he should drive to on the Friday before the crash.
He said that on Friday evening, he was getting messages about where to go, and which led him down a road in Essex. That led him into a field. He got out of his truck, and then he was getting messages from Facebook throughout as he was in the field, and Facebook was telling him where to go and what to do as he was going through the field, down a path, ultimately through a culvert to some water, where he destroyed his phone.
No such messages were found. Detective Sergeant Eric Jollymore testified that he examined Stephen's computer found in his bedroom. He said there were about 50 Google searches and over 20 Wikipedia searches. He testified that none of them were unusual. The state's last rebuttal witness was Dr. Paul Cotton, who testified that in his opinion, Stephen was not insane, and that he knew his actions were wrong at the time of the crash. He said Stephen did tell him that after the crash, he went over to the Jetta and saw what he thought were mannequins, which he said was frightening and bizarre. But when asked if that was an example of delusional thoughts, Dr. Cotton said sometimes when a catastrophic event occurs, people in the immediate aftermath can have irrational thoughts. He admitted that it does raise questions whether he was coming to grips with seeing what happened or whether it was part of a mental disease. But he said in his opinion, he believes it was more the acute single thought rather than a mental disease. He concluded that Stephen had adjustment disorder with disturbance of mood behavior, not a mental disease. He said he found that the stressors in Stephen's life led to his actions. As for when Stephen stole the police cruiser and then crashed back into the scene at over 100 miles per hour, he said it seemed to him that Stephen was just so overwhelmed by the whole thing that he lost it in terms of his behaviors, but that doesn't mean he was legally insane. While the state had to prove Stephen's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the defense only had to show that he was legally insane by a preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not. So what would the jury think? We would later find out that at the start of their deliberations, the jury was split. But 12 hours later, all would decide that Stephen Burgoyne was sane when he drove his pickup truck the wrong way that night, killing 5 teenagers. Mary Harris, Cyrus Sow, Liam Hale, Eli Brookins, and Janie Kazi. At his sentencing, several family members of the victims spoke, and emotional videos of the teens were played in court. Stephen apologized to the victims' families and was then sentenced to 30 years to life. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you think Stephen was legally insane that night? Or do you think there was another reason for what he did? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or emailing me at podcast@CourtJunkie.com. If you'd like to hear these episodes ad-free and to check out additional bonus episodes, go to CourtJunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.